Now, most people today, within the Western world in which we live, that is, and most people don't generally believe that there is overarching truth to be known and to be believed and to be lived by. And as a result, they say that we should therefore not be narrow and bigoted, that we should not be divisive. Rather, because there is no certain truth for us to live by, that we should be totally open and fully tolerant of all others. However, is that actually possible? Is it truly possible? Is it really possible for us to be completely open and to be fully tolerant? Well, no, it isn't. For to believe that we should be completely open and tolerant, to believe that is also to believe that not to be completely open and tolerant is therefore wrong. Which, if you think about it, even just for a moment or two, that is an utter contradiction, isn't it? You see, this world has some very odd attitudes towards truth. In fact, within today's world, there are three specific misunderstandings of what truth is, which are extremely prevalent. There are three ways of thinking about truth which are held or expressed in some way or other by most people within this world. First, many people say, well, we believe what we believe because of our past experience. Therefore, it's only our past experience which determines and shapes what we believe and consider to be truth today. Indeed, we can often say this ourselves, can't we? For we can say, oh, he only thinks that way because of such an experience in the past that he's had, or because of the way he was brought up, or something else just like that. Actually, there's a song by Anne Russell from many, many years ago. This is betraying my age, isn't it? Which wonderfully captures this wrong-headed way of looking at truth. It goes like this. The song goes like this. I went to my psychiatrist to be psychoanalyzed, to find out why I killed the cat and blacked my husband's eyes. He laid me on a downy couch to see what he could find. So this is what he dredged up from my subconscious mind. When I was one, my mummy hid my dolly in a trunk, and so it follows naturally that I am always drunk. When I was two, I saw my father kiss the maid one day, and that is why I suffer now from kleptomania. At three, I had the feeling of ambivalence towards my brothers, and so it follows naturally I poisoned all my lovers. But I am happy. Now I've learned the lesson this has taught. Everything I do that's wrong is someone else's fault. Now, no humorous. That song actually, it truly nails, doesn't it, the problem of this incorrect view on the head. For yes, past experience does, and it certainly can shape what we think and believe. But to base our understanding of truth solely upon our past experience, well, it demeans both our capability to think and to reason independently, but also, far more importantly, it also demeans our own moral responsibility towards truth and towards right and wrong. In other words, we try to excuse what we do simply on the basis of our past. That's what we're doing. However, as Paul writes in Romans 1, verse 20, since the creation of this world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, been understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. We can't excuse ourselves because of our past, no matter what we've gone through. Now, the second incorrect attitude towards truth is the common view held today that we simply determine for ourselves what is true. And this misunderstanding of truth can be seen, and it's worked out today, in modern day attitudes towards same-sex marriage, for example, and towards abortion, and towards euthanasia. Of course, there's a problem here, isn't there? A real problem. For other cultures and other generations have held contrary opinions upon these things. So this truth, does then truth change? Does truth change? Does it? And indeed, if ethnic cleansing or child abuse are one day, somehow and in some way, they're considered morally acceptable by the majority, does that then make them morally acceptable? Does it? You see, in reality, both of these two views, that is, past experience is all that shapes our view of truth today, or what the majority believes, whichever one you happen to choose, in reality, both of these two truths, these two views rather, are saying that there is no absolute truth. For at the end of the day, they're both claiming that we cannot say that something is always true and that something else is always not true. So everything is relative, isn't it? That's what they're saying. However, if that is right, then that belief is in itself that there's no absolute truth, then that belief is in itself being held as an absolute truth, isn't it? Think about it. In other words, both of those views, past experience or majority belief, both are contradictory ways to look upon truth. They just don't satisfy, do they? They just don't explain reality to us. Now, the third common misunderstanding of truth today is what we've already touched upon. And it's much more consistent, actually, than the other two, even though it's wrong. It's a misunderstanding. For this view of truth states that there is no truth at all. It states that we can do whatever we like. It states that we have absolute and unrestrained freedom. Life, you see, is to be totally open. And we're to be fully tolerant of everyone and on everything. It sounds good, does it? It sounds idyllic. It's what many believe today. However, can freedom itself be so endlessly open-ended? Can it? Can we really live just as we like? Can we? Well, no, we can't. And in our heart of hearts, we know that, don't we? For example, if you truly want to be free to enjoy a happy marriage, then you really cannot do certain things within that marriage, like being unfaithful to your spouse. You can't. So there really is no such thing as absolute and unrestrained freedom. And to enjoy life really does mean that you have to follow rules. And therefore, ultimately, the only way for you to experience joyous freedom within your life, so to speak, is for you to live in total submission to the God who has made you. That's the only way. For God is a God who reveals truth and makes laws. God is a God who legislates. God is a God who tells us what is true and what is not true. God is a God who tells us what is right and what is wrong. God is a God who tells us what to do and what not to do. And therefore, to enjoy life, we need to live in submission to Him, God who has made us. So let's turn now. Let's look at what this God requires from us. Let's consider the God who reveals truth and makes laws. Firstly, let's consider God's name. Four headings for this evening. We'll go through them fairly quickly. But let's firstly consider God's name. Now, last time we saw how God entered into a covenant relationship with Abraham and his descendants. For God had determined to bless Abraham and to make his descendants into a great nation. And also, through Abraham and his descendants, specifically through one of Abraham's descendants, a promised seed of Abraham, God had also determined to bring blessing to all peoples on earth. Now, Abraham's family grew and they went down to live within Egypt. However, there within Egypt, after a few hundred years, they'd become slaves to the Egyptians. So what did God do? For God had promised great things for and through this nation. So what did God do? Well, he raised up Moses, didn't he? Why? In order to rescue the nation of Israel out of slavery within Egypt. He raised up Moses. Now, to Moses, and also to us today, God reveals his name. We see this in Exodus 3, verses 13 to 15. A remarkable passage, in fact. Exodus 3, verses 13 to 15. God said Moses said to God, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you.' And they ask me, 'What is his name?' Then what shall I tell them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you." God also said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you.'" So God's name is I am who I am. That is God's name. Now, what does that name signify? In other words, what does God's name reveal to us about the truth of who God is? For in a way, it's a very strange name, isn't it? It's a very odd name. It's a very peculiar name. So what does it mean? What does it mean? Well, very simply, because I could spend a whole sermon on it, but very simply, it means that we ourselves cannot put God in a box. We ourselves cannot determine what or who God is. We cannot define God, so to speak. For God is exactly what God is, and nothing else. God is the eternal subject, if I can put it in that way, and he's not someone else's object. Therefore, God himself says what he is, not someone else. "I am who I am," says God. And what a glorious truth and comfort that is. For God is God. He cannot be defined by us. We cannot categorize him. We cannot put him in a box. He's the eternal, self-sufficient God. He's the one from whom all else comes. And yet he's also the one who does reveal something of himself to us. He is the I am who I am. And as Moses finds out later, he's the one who proclaims in Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7, "The Lord, the Lord, the I am who I am, the I am who I am, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished." And that's exactly how God defines himself. He is the I am who I am. Secondly, let's look now at God's law. You see, as the Israelite nation escapes from Egypt under Moses' leadership, but more importantly through God's power in judgment against the nation of Egypt, so they're brought by God to a mountain within the desert. That mountain is Mount Sinai. And it's here, upon this mountain, that God enters into another covenant relationship. However, this time it's not with a single person, with Abraham, as we saw last time, but with a group of people, with the nation of Israel itself. It's another covenant. It's a different covenant. Now, in the New Testament, it's this covenant relationship with the nation of Israel which is referred to as the first covenant or the old covenant. Whereas the covenant relationship which Jesus himself introduces is the new or everlasting covenant. For example, in Hebrews 8, verse 13, we read, by calling this covenant new, that is the covenant established by Jesus, by calling this covenant new, he has made the first one, that is the covenant of God with Israel, he has made the first one obsolete. And what is obsolete and outdated will soon disappear. Now, at the very heart of this old or Mosaic covenant are the Ten Commandments. We read through those Ten Commandments a little bit earlier, didn't we? They're found in, as we read, in Exodus 20, verses 1 to 17. But they're also found again in Deuteronomy 5, verses 6 to 21. The first four commandments deal with our relationship to God. They prescribe how we are to love God with all our heart, mind, soul and strength. The last six commandments, well, they deal with our relationship to each other. They prescribe how we're to love our neighbour as ourselves. So let's look very, we don't have time to look at all ten commandments, so let's look very briefly at the first four commandments which deal with our relationship to God. Now the first commandment is about God's exclusiveness. God's exclusiveness. There's only one God, you see. You shall have no other gods before me, God commands. So God insists upon 100% wholehearted allegiance to him and to him alone. That's what God insists upon. In other words, he doesn't leave us to make up our own gods, or no God at all for that matter. No. He doesn't leave us to think and to do what we want to think and to do. No. And that's actually also for our good, isn't it? God desires complete allegiance to the God who has made us and to the God who has saved us. He's the exclusive God. There is no other. The second commandment is about God's transcendence. God's transcendence. For God is above and beyond everything else. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. That's what God commands. God insists, you see, that he's utterly different from any created thing. In other words, we cannot reduce God or domesticate God or try to capture God and thus bring God in some way under our own control. No. Indeed, as we've already seen, God is the I am who I am. He's the transcendent God. The third commandment is about God's absolute importance. For only God is to be praised and worshipped. Only God. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. That's what God commands. God insists, you see, that we glorify him and give to him the honour and the praise which is his due. In other words, we cannot do anything but praise and worship God alone. For when we say, oh God, without thinking, or we say Jesus, when we're taken by surprise, then we're diminishing God, aren't we? Why? Because we're taking God's name and treating it as if it's not something special, but as something common, And that diminishes and that cheapens God, doesn't it? But no, God is a God of absolute importance. The fourth commandment is about God's right to reign. For God, and only God, has full authority to determine how we're to live and how we're to use our time. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labour and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. That's what God commands. So God insists that he himself determines the very pattern of our lives, not us. For God is the one who is in control. God is the one who's in charge. God is our Lord and King. And God insists that we preserve a day devoted to the Lord our God. God is the God who reigns over our lives. God is a God who makes laws, and we are to obey them. Thirdly, as we've considered God's name and God's law, let's look now at God's presence. God's presence. For this covenant relationship of God with the nation of Israel also required a tabernacle, later to become a temple, and sacrifices. Now the tabernacle itself symbolizes where God's presence is. And so the sacrifices show to us that in order for us to meet with God requires the shedding of blood. It requires sacrifice. For God is holy. God is righteous. And we are sinners. We're fallen. We all stand guilty before him because of our sin. The breaking of God's law. And that's true for each one of us, isn't it? So sacrifice is required. Sin has to be dealt with. Sin has to be atoned. Indeed, this has been the consistent message of the Bible right up to this point of the giving of the covenant and law to the nation of Israel. It's been there all along, hasn't it? For remember how Adam and Eve were driven away from God's presence because of their sin? They broke God's law. So how can they get back into God's presence? Only through sacrifice. Pictured, wasn't it, in the skins that God made for them to wear. Blood had been shed. And this is also true for Abraham. This is also true for Isaac. This is also true for Jacob. And now this is also true for the nation of Israel. Leviticus 16 verse 2, the Lord said to Moses, tell your brother Aaron, that is the high priest, that he is not to come whenever he chooses into the most holy place or the holiest of all, or else he will die. For I will appear in the cloud over the atonement cover. This is how Aaron is to enter the most holy place. He must first bring a young bull for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. Therefore, for men and women to enter into God's presence, symbolized by the tabernacle there at the beginning of the nation of Israel, for men and women to enter into God's presence, for them to know God and for them to be accepted by God, requires the guilt of their sin, the breaking of God's law to be dealt with. It requires a sacrifice. It requires the shedding of blood. Which is exactly why the writer of the letter to the Hebrews writes in Hebrews 9, verse 22, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Of course, all these sacrifices of animals cannot truly take away our sin. Indeed, for that, a perfect sacrifice is required. Hebrews 9, verse 13. Blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkled on those who are ceremonially unclean sanctify them so that they are outwardly clean. How much more then will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death so that we may serve the living God. Greater sacrifice is needed, isn't it? The death of Jesus upon a cross to truly purge away all our sin. So this account of God's covenant relationship with the fledgling nation of Israel reveals to us the truth of God's name, God's law, and God's presence only by means of sacrifice. So let's look finally, very briefly, at how it also reveals to us the truth of God's character. Indeed, we've touched upon this already when considering God's name. For in Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7, God discloses truth about himself. Amazing, wonderful, glorious truth concerning himself. God discloses that he is both compassionate and righteous, wonderfully loving and fearfully holy, both at the same time. Indeed, let me read those two verses to you again. The Lord passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. There it is. Wonderfully loving, fearfully holy, both compassionate and righteous at the same time. Isn't that amazing? God is both compassionate and righteous. God is both loving and just. God both forgives sins, and yet God also cannot pretend sin is not there. And that's exactly what God reveals about himself in this covenant relationship which he establishes with the fledgling nation of Israel. God is both compassionate and righteous, just. Of course, that leaves us with a problem, doesn't it? A serious problem. For which the sacrifices of the tabernacle, they actually also point to a solution, don't they? As we've already seen. For how can we put those two things about God, his compassion and his justice, how can we put them together? For it's all very well knowing God's law, but we break it, don't we? Again and again and again. It's all very well knowing the truth about God, but we live for ourselves, not for his glory alone. Well, the only way for those two things, God's compassion and God's justice, the only way for those two things to be put together is through substitution. It's through Jesus Christ himself dying for us. It's through Jesus Christ taking all our wrongdoing upon himself and dying in our place as our substitute and sacrifice and representative. It's through Jesus Christ himself fulfilling all the symbolism of the sacrifices. It's through Jesus Christ himself satisfying God's compassion and God's justice on the cross for us. As it says in Romans, God demonstrates God's love and God's justice there on the cross. It's through Jesus Christ, is it? We have a glorious God who is worthy of all our praise. Amen.